I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're looking at things that have changed and things that are still in flux. From mothers balancing new lifestyles to the social stigma surrounding pumpkin spice.
You got rid of the star rating system and talked about, like, I'm not going to use the word ethnic when I talk about food.
They recognized that safety was our motivation, and they were very, you know, receptive to the changes, understanding what we were trying to accomplish.
A cupcake or a piece of bacon or a glass of rosé is not inherently gendered.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Melissa Fuster, standing in for Coral Lee. This episode is part of a special series in collaboration with Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. Our new issue features articles and special sections on ingredients from salmon to chicken, taste and technology in East Asia, and excursions, an exploration of food and mobility. As well, Gastronomica continues to publish its COVID dispatches, short portraits of early responses to the food crisis of this pandemic. For 6 weeks, join hosts from the Gastronomica Editorial Collective as we talk with authors. Our guest this week is John Gifford, who will be talking more about his article, Salmon at the Table. John Gifford is a writer and photographer. He is the author of Pig in America, Exploring a Cultural Icon, published by the University Press of Kansas 2019, and Red Dirt Country, Field Notes and Essays on Nature, from the University of Oklahoma Press 2019. His essays on food and nature have appeared in Southwest Review, The Atlantic, Kestrel, and Notre Dame Magazine. John, thank you for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Melissa. Glad to be here.
Good. Okay, so I wanted to begin by learning more about your work. How do you first get interested in salmon? How does this fit with your other work in photography and writing?
My work, especially in the last 5 years, seems to center especially on food and nature, and sometimes at the intersection of food and nature. And salmon was, it wasn't really my initial focus. I traveled, my wife and I traveled to Vancouver Island in the spring of 2019 with the idea of photographing wildlife and some of the island's landscapes and some of the seascapes and just nature photography, basically. And of course, while we were there, we learned about the salmon farms we encountered in Clayoquot Sound, this enormous, beautiful wilderness off the Pacific coast of Vancouver Island. And they were quite unexpected because they were these large industrial facilities in an otherwise pristine wilderness. And my initial thought at the time, having done a little bit of work in writing about agriculture, the Pecan America book you'd mentioned being the latest example of that, I was under the impression that because it was aquaculture and salmon farming, it was necessarily a positive thing because aquaculture is helping alleviate stress on beleaguered wild populations of fish worldwide. And so I thought a salmon farm here in the Pacific Northwest where there are native salmon must be a good thing. But I was informed otherwise. And it kind of started an educational journey about this business that I've learned a lot about in the year or year and a half since this trip. So it was enlightening, to say the least.
No, definitely. And it's very interesting that what you do in the piece to show us that. And I wanted to, if you can tell us more for our listeners. In the opening of the article, you talk about this voyage in this biosphere in Vancouver, where you first encounter the aquaculture farm. For many of us that haven't seen these farms, these structures, can you tell us more about it? What was your experience, that first encounter?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, it was quite unexpected. You're back in this sound, which is something like a vast and wild bay. You're surrounded on all sides by coastal temperate rainforest, and these waters are wild. They're teeming with, or used to be teeming with, wild salmon. And my guide, Captain Mike White, whose boat, the Browning Passage, we were aboard that day, a cabin cruiser, he takes guests out into this area for photography, and he informed us that about once a month he sees orcas or killer whales in this area, in these waters. They're hunting for salmon, he says. We didn't see any on my trip, but we saw bald eagles, black bears, evidence of wolves, just a little of everything, it seemed, except the orcas. But at some point, we saw something just completely out of place in this setting, and it was an enormous, maybe a football size net enclosure. It was accompanied by some small buildings, everything floating, of course, colorful buoys on the perimeter, and it just looked strange. And I was told, oh, that's a salmon farm, and that's there are several of them here in Clayoquot Sound, and it was owned, I learned, by Cermaq, which, as I understand, is a subsidiary of the Mitsubishi Corporation of Japan. So when I learned this, I was taken aback initially that big business had infiltrated somehow the pristine wilderness. It was really an incredible sight, and one I thought was out of place. But I initially accepted it because, as I mentioned, I thought the raising of farm salmon to meet a worldwide demand for seafood was a positive thing. But as I later learned, it was not exactly what it seemed.
Yeah, no, and we do get, even as I was reading the piece, I was myself surprised that you begin by describing this amazing natural wilderness, and then suddenly this farm, that it blows my mind further that you mentioned that it's the size of a football field, you said?
That's a rough estimate, and it was a lot larger than you might think, a netted enclosure. They call these net pen enclosures. They're fences of netting that completely enclose the salmon. And I don't recall whether they're enclosed on the top or not, but I think they may be because the eagles and other raptors that would otherwise try and prey on these salmon. But they're pretty well protected, and it just strikes you because they're so out of place in the wilderness.
And was it crowded, or were you able to see, I don't know, how the condition of the salmon within the enclosure?
We didn't get that close. I can only imagine, because I later learned that 100,000+, sometimes more, salmon are packed into these enclosures in very tight confines. So I'm sure it was very crowded had we ventured closely enough, but we didn't get that close. I would assume the caretakers or the guardians of this enterprise probably wouldn't appreciate visitors getting that close.
Yeah, and taking pictures, I also guess,
taking
right?
Taking pictures. I did snap a photo. I don't know that I'll ever use it, but, you know, there may come a time when it serves an article or an essay that I write. But it was just a little bit surprising to me to see this. And it was I've known about aquaculture, but never in a wilderness setting. So this is a new experience for me. And I think everyone aboard our boat that day, we had maybe six or eight of us that day on the boat.
Wow. No, and definitely, again, also a surprise for me, and I'm guessing for a lot of our listeners. And I wanted, if you can share more, because you do mention, for example, that you had conversation with local fishermen about the salmon. And I was also surprised when one of them mentioned that they go, the salmon moves, they take it to Japan, right?
Yes, these were this was later, a few days later, and these were actually crab fishermen. They my wife and I, one of my interests is in photographing fishing harbors, and we found a fishing dock full of a commercial fleet of crab boats. And the crab fishermen, some didn't want to visit with us, but we found a few who were very friendly and open to chatting with us. And they told us that the crab that they caught, I believe it was blue crab. I can't recall for sure, but I believe it was blue crab that they had been fishing for. And it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a weekday. They had already been out since early that morning, caught their crab, had brought it back, and it had already been sent for shipment to Japan. He told me all of their crab they catch goes straight to Japan. So I know Japan has a voracious appetite for seafood. It's a huge part of the culture in that country. And I've been made to understand that they scour the world's oceans searching for, enough fish to appease their appetites, not only in Japan, but probably worldwide, too. But this was evidence for me that the hunt for seafood is now a global game. This is no longer confined to national waters, but international and global waters. Everything was, with today's technology, aboard these fishing vessels, commercial fishing vessels, then I suppose no area in the world's oceans is off limits anymore.
Can you, I don't know if you have other anecdotes or something that didn't make it to the piece about these interactions with the fishermen, about their attitudes or perceptions about aquaculture and this global trade?
Well, I didn't. I spoke with a few locals, but I got a lot of my information about this from the boat captain and from my photography guides, who knew quite a lot about this. They gave me kind of a crash course in aquaculture, and then after my trip, upon my return home, I began my research, and I learned that there's big business salmon farming going on there in British Columbia, which I had seen and witnessed, and much the same in the countries of Chile and I believe Norway. And I don't know that all of it is owned and operated by the same company or just different companies, but it's a big business, and it seems to the detrimental type of salmon farming, or what I've been made to understand is detrimental to the environment, is this open water net pen aquaculture in which farmed fish are raised in the same environment as wild fish. And wild salmon today are just beleaguered by so many different factors. And I've been made to understand this is one of them. And with a commercial salmon farm growing this salmon on this magnitude, you've got, like I said, tens of thousands, maybe 100 or more thousand fish in a netted pen enclosure. And these enclosures, of course, are open to seawater. The seawater is free to flow through the net, and it's tidally influenced. And so when the tide comes in, it can really spread these effluents, these unnatural concentrations of effluents that can carry disease or whatnot, and reach wild populations of fish. And so, because of the environment these fish are being farmed in, they're being raised in the same environment as wild salmon, and wild salmon are subjected to, if there's a disease in the population of farmed salmon, that could easily transmit to the wild fish. And there's a lot of feelings there in Tofino and Vancouver Island, locally there, as well as elsewhere, that wherever you find farmed salmon, wild salmon, I've heard it mentioned more than once, are in decline. And a few months after my visit to Vancouver Island, I understand there was a massive fish kill at these same Clayoquot Sound salmon farms. Just hundreds, tens or hundreds of thousands of dead salmon. And it was the media reports a few months later blamed it on an algae bloom. And that just affected all of these farmed salmon. And if there were any wild salmon in the vicinity, it seems plausible it would have affected them as well. We don't know this, of course. I don't know this. I'm not privy to that kind of information, but it's just another threat for the wild salmon, which are finding it harder and harder to survive anymore in these environments. You know, it's dams, it's other habitat degradation, and now it's commercial aquaculture challenging them just for their very survival. And I talked to a salmon expert not long ago, and he told me that that among the mid-latitudes, so he's describing that as California, the Pacific Northwest, and Vancouver Island, populations of wild salmon in this area is a paltry, roughly 1 to 7% of historical numbers. So it's crashed significantly. He did say that wild salmon in northern latitudes, Alaska, for example, seem to be doing pretty well. And interestingly, wild salmon appear to be spreading their territory in the Arctic Ocean, which makes sense because of climate change. They need cool, clean water, both in the ocean and in freshwater streams for spawning. So they seem to be doing well there. But here in the mid-latitudes, not so much. And it's disturbing to hear this. I know that they used to offer sport fishing for salmon in the Clayoquot Sound and these waters off Vancouver Island. And I understand that that is no longer the case. Over the last 2 years, I think that that industry and these recreational opportunities for those so inclined have been terminated because the salmon are in such low numbers. The numbers of returning salmon each year just get fewer and fewer, and it's a biological emergency, basically, is what we have up there, and probably in other areas around the world.
Definitely, and yes, we are going to be talking about the wild salmon aspect and the fishermen further, but first we're going to take a short break. And we'll be back in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008. And has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
And we're back. This is Meant to be Eaten with Melissa Fuster, talking with John Gifford about his article, Salmon on the Table, available in the current issue of Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. Before the break, John, you shared with us your experience encountering aquaculture, the salmon farm in Vancouver. In your piece, you contrast this experience with your encounter of wild salmon fishing in Michigan. Can you tell us more about this second encounter that you write about with the two young boys fishing for salmon?
I can and I will. First, I'd like to delineate just briefly between the commercial aquaculture in a wilderness setting or this open water aquaculture I experienced in Vancouver Island and land-based aquaculture, which critics of wilderness aquaculture, of open water net pen salmon farming, all seem to agree that it's not aquaculture itself that's harmful. It's just where it's being done. And if we can find a way to move these operations into an isolated area on land where they're separated from wild populations, then while that comes with an added expense of operational equipment and so forth, that's actually better for the salmon, the wild salmon, and the environment. And so as different as those two seem to be, my experience in northern Michigan, watching two young men from a local Ottawa tribe hunt salmon with a spear was vastly different and equally surprising to me. I was in northern Michigan last autumn photographing along a stream. I was trying to capture some of the region's autumn colors. They're just stunning there. I've never been anywhere where the autumn colors are as beautiful as they are in northern Michigan. And I was photographing along a small creek about a mile from its confluence with Lake Michigan when I noticed movement. I looked down the stream and two boys were walking up the stream in waders. The older one had a spear in his hands, and so I knew right away what they were doing. But my surprise was, how could there be any salmon in this small waterway? This is a tiny waterway, and the water no more than 2 feet deep at, you know, the deepest part of the pool in front of me. And I went down and talked with the boys, and their mother was with them. She was on the bank. And after they continued on, I spoke with her. And this is part of their cultural tradition of finding food as a way of subsistence fishing, so to speak, for winter. It's just a matter of survival for them. The winters are long and cold in northern Michigan, and here's a resource available to them. They were able to take advantage of that. And what surprised me was the older boy, the one with the spear, was teaching his younger brother how to do this. And he seemed very confident that there would be a salmon up ahead in this pool. And I was again, surprised that is not only at his confidence, but that there could be any salmon in the pool. But while I was conversing with his mother, the two boys went up ahead, and Sure enough, here a moment later, they flushed what turned out to be two salmon. They got one of them, and one of them escaped downstream. And this was not a small salmon. This was a 10, 12-pound salmon. And afterwards, he was very proud. He came out of the water, hoisted his fish, and this was something that was going to feed them this winter. You know, it was just a hyper-local type of fishing, one that the consumer was just actively involved in procuring, in this case, his dinner, his future dinner, that impressed me. He went out and he took matters into his own hands, and he went and he caught a salmon for his dinner. And he could have gone off after the other one, but he didn't. He had one, and he felt that was sufficient or satisfactory. And after we visited with him for a while, they got in their pickup and left with their salmon and went home. And it was just the personal nature of what I had seen of this family rallying around this tradition and being so actively and directly involved in procuring their food that was so impressive to me. And they were keeping their cultural tradition alive. I understand that salmon were introduced into the Great Lakes in the 1960s, so they're not native here. But for a couple of generations now, the First Nations have been relying on this resource as a way to feed themselves in the winter. And before the salmon, I understand that they did the same with other fish like walleye. So spear fishing was a way for them to collect protein for the winter. And they were carrying on that tradition. And I thought that was impressive, especially in today's culture where we just we rely on others to feed us, essentially. And these young men were out there with their spear and their waders, and they were willing to get dirty to get their food, and that was honorable.
Yes, and you do mention that members of the First Nations do have those fishing rights secured by law.
Yes,
but then if we know from some of the U.S. history, these treaties or treaties that have happened with, you know, in Canada and also here in the U.S. are not always honored, unfortunately, throughout history. So when you had the conversation with the mother or in some of your other research, what is the status of these fishing rights? Did you see that they were in danger or anything going on around that?
I'm not aware of any imminent threats to fishing rights. As I understand, you mentioned that I think it was an 1836 Treaty of Washington essentially guarantees the fishing rights for the First Nations tribes and in this area. And because of that, they were able to procure a permit to hunt spear or a spearfish for salmon. And I did phone the visit with a representative from the Department of Natural Resources in Michigan, and I was under the impression or led to understand that not anyone can go and get one of these spearfishing permits. I believe these are limited to First Nations, but they still have to have a permit to do this. And it's for a short time at a certain time of the year. And it's just a way for them to realize and preserve their cultural history, as I understand. And I thought it was impressive. As I said, you know, so many ways today we've kind of turned to others to provide our food. But when you see someone willing to go out and get their own food, that's something to it gets my attention, and it's just something to witness.
And you did mention that that there have been in the past, in the recent past, some proposals for aquaculture to come into the area, right?
Yes, that was my understanding. I, in visiting with the gentleman from the Department of Natural Resources in Michigan, I was told that a few years ago, a proposal was made to introduce commercial open water net pen salmon farming into the Great Lakes. So if this would have passed, it would have been the same scenario as what we saw in Vancouver Island. And but the differences here, as I understand, was there was a strong opposition from local sport fishing groups that that eventually put down this proposal. And so it seems unlikely to occur here anytime soon just because of the strong resistance against it. And I should say that there is definitely strong resistance against what's going on in Vancouver Island. A few months, I mentioned this earlier, but a few months after my visit there in the spring of 2019, there was a rally of local residents, First Nations leaders, and others basically protesting against the salmon farming going on there in Clayoquot Sound. And I think their anger and their frustration was prescient because of the eventual salmon kill that happened that autumn, last autumn. And so I don't know where it stands now, whether anything's being done differently or plans to eliminate salmon farming, commercial salmon farming, or at least aquaculture, salmon aquaculture from this area. But at the time, there was strong opposition against that as well.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you if you can talk a little bit more about the local sport fishing groups. I'm wondering, and I'm a city girl. Like I don't know so much about fishing, so some of this comes from this curiosity about how these groups interact. Meaning, if there is a, for example, do the local the sport fishing groups, do they, for example, collaborate with the First Nation tribes to try to prevent aquaculture coming in? Do they talk to each other? Are they overlaps between these groups?
I don't know the answer to that. I would assume they do to some extent because they have a common interest in this resource, this salmon resource. One is obviously for food, but the Great Lakes salmon fishery has grown into a very strong commercial industry. You can go to Michigan, for example, and you can hire a captain to take you out on a sport fishing charter for salmon in Lake Michigan, and I'm sure many of the other Great Lakes. But it's big business, and it's something that that has contributed a lot to the economy of the Great Lakes states. And so introducing commercial aquaculture to the Great Lakes ostensibly would have open the pathway to potential, you know, disease transmission or any of the other undesirable effects of large scale open water commercial aquaculture. And so their resistance or strong resistance to this eventually essentially has saved, at least for the time, saved their commercial salmon fishing industry.
Very interesting how this group and opposition worked out. And so when you ended the article, I like that you end with a with a hopeful note for the preservation of fishing, seeing this as a cultural tradition to be passed, like you mentioned, from the older young men to the younger brother. But at the same time, I think, of course, that we all have a stake in the future of wild salmon, as we're all connected, right? Mm-hmm. How aware do you think people are about these connections or the consequences of the loss of the wild salmon outside from these areas?
I think because of our culture and society today being how it is with, we're no longer primarily an agrarian society. Most of us live in urban areas and suburban areas today, and we go to the grocery store for our food rather than raising it or procuring it ourselves. And as I mentioned earlier, when you see someone else out doing that and securing their own dinner, it gets your attention. I've seen this in Florida and in other places. I recall in one time on the Gulf Coast of Florida, out on a fishing pier that goes out into the Gulf, a mother and her son or teenage son fishing. And like there were other people fishing that day, but I was attracted to them because the teenager, the son, had a quite a large fish on the line. And I went over to see if I could help him land it. And so I was able to help him land this mackerel, I think it was, and it was a quite a large mackerel. I pulled it up from the water all the way up to the pier. I gave him the fish, and I thought they would just put it in an ice chest or whatever and keep fishing like everyone else. And instead, they had their dinner, and that was enough for them. They grabbed their gear and went straight home. And that struck me as they were out here looking for dinner. This is a way for them to feed themselves. And it's that way in the Great Lakes and in other places. And I just think that when you see a tradition like First Nations members out, hunting for salmon for their winter food, a winter food source, it really gets you. And it shows you things haven't gotten so far out of whack that they can't do this any longer. And you also think, too, about the salmon. They're a lot like us. They're navigating these increasingly shallow waters, narrow channels, trying to ascend these streams to reproduce. But it's becoming harder and harder to do because of the dams and other impediments that we've put in their place. And so until you see this in person, you just think your salmon comes from the grocery store, I think, or your fishmonger. You don't think about exactly the environment it came from or the effort that went into securing it. But I don't know. I was really impressed by watching these young men. And it's not that it was fishing or anything so much as it was just the cultural tradition of what they've been taught, what they've lived and known, and their parents and grandparents have lived and known, and that they were willing to put on waders and go out and get wet and dirty and carry on this tradition to feed themselves was very impressive to me. And I think that's easily lost in all the noise and distractions that we have in our society today. We might overlook something this simple, but it's so vital to who we are.
Definitely. And I really like that you emphasize in these stories the idea that they take from nature what they need and not more, which is something I think we don't tend to do, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think this is something beyond the salmon that we need to remember from stories like this.
Well, there's so much we can learn from the residents who were here on this continent before most of us, the First Nations, and they have a history of living in harmony with their environment and taking what they need, and their environment was always there for them and has always been there for them. And we can learn so much from that, among fishermen, there's a lot of belief that you need to catch only what you can eat for dinner that night. Don't, stock up your freezer or anything, because there's no need to do that. And the fish won't be as fresh in 2 months from now as they will tonight. And if you do that, then they'll be here the next time you want to catch some. And I think that taking a larger vision, a larger view of what we're doing in the outdoors and with our environment is so important, and we can't forget that.
Definitely. And I wanted to close with one, I mean, it does relate to what we're talking about. One more question. What, I mean, based on your experience, not only with this piece, but also your other work, taking nature photography, interacting with nature, what are some potential takeaways or things that we as consumers need to think about? And thinking, for example, of some, maybe some of our listeners, I know certainly myself, as I told you, I am in Brooklyn, New York, so fishing and all of that process is alien for many of us. So what can we do as we are selecting fish or just selecting our food moving forward?
I think one of the things that you can do, that we can all do, is question where your food comes from. You know, like a lot of people, before I had this experience in Vancouver Island and learning about commercial aquaculture, I would go to the restaurant, and if I saw salmon on the menu frequently, I would choose that. I love seafood, and I eat that more than beef or chicken or any other type of protein. And when I would see salmon, I would order salmon. I never thought about where it came from, and I just thought, well, if it, I knew that there was aquaculture and salmon farming, and I just thought this was as good as, you know, one place was as good as anywhere else. And it wasn't until I had this experience in Vancouver and began to understand the ramifications of open water net pen aquaculture that I started to understand the differences between farmed and wild salmon. And while I'm not opposed to eating farmed salmon at all, and I would welcome that, I think it's helpful to ask where your food comes from and maybe express your wish or even demand that that these items, you know, your food is sustainably produced, sustainably caught, and what as much as is feasible. And even, you know, there's a lot of restaurants you can go to and find wild salmon, which in this day and age of imperiled fish populations across our globe, it's amazing to me that there are still such a large number and healthy population of wild Pacific salmon off Alaska, for example, that we can go and enjoy that at a restaurant. I think just asking where your food comes from and insisting that your restaurant, the restaurant manager, whomever, is able to provide sustainably caught seafood, because that is something that you care about and that you do notice, and that we all pay. We all vote, so to speak, with our wallets. If we're buying wild food, wild salmon in this case, and insisting on wild salmon, there's a market for that, and there's an incentive for our restaurants to carry wild salmon. Or, and conversely, with farmed salmon, there's an incentive for them to buy salmon that have been farmed ethically and sustainably, and maybe land-based systems that do not threaten or imperil wild populations of salmon. It's just a matter of asking and talking and just expressing your wishes to those in power to make a difference or shape this.
Definitely. And also, I like exactly what you did, taking the interest in understanding a lot of these issues, because they're very, very complex, as your piece beautifully explained to us.
Well, thank you. I want to end by saying I'm not opposed to farmed salmon at all, provided they're, like I said, produced sustainably in a way that doesn't imperil wild populations of salmon. But I think among farmed salmon and wild salmon, there is a difference. You can see a deeper red color with the wild fish and a more savory flavor. But then I'm someone who can appreciate the delicacy and the maybe the more mild flavor of farmed salmon. So I think there is a place for both of them. And I think there's a way for both to coexist and for the aquaculture industry to make a good living from producing salmon, but just producing them in the right way, a way that's going to be in harmony with our wild salmon, or allow for the reintroduction and health of our wild salmon stocks.
Yes, so definitely it's not that clear about, it's just a matter of understanding this more. And there, like you say, there could be ways of doing farm fish, farm salmon in a good way also for the wild salmon.
I've read about a company in the Middle East, I believe it was, far from any wild stocks of salmon, producing farm salmon in an aquarium made from an old ship's hull. I thought that was a kind of a wild idea and enterprise, but apparently it's working for them. And so this was just to contain the operation so that these farm salmon are completely isolated from any water, any native fish populations, salmon or otherwise. I thought that was interesting.
No, yes, it's so interesting. And I've learned so much from your article and even more from these conversations. Thank you, John. For joining us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Of course, of course. It's been a pleasure. And I also want to invite the listeners to read your article, your full article in Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. It is already out, volume 20.4. And for more details, visit gastronomica.org. And again, you can read the full article, and you also have really good references for people that are interested in learning more, then they can go and read those. So thank you again. And I want to just remind our listeners to join us next week as we talk to Adrian Bitar on decoding miracle food cures for COVID-19. Thank you.
Meant to Be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.